You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
We've got a fascinating conversation to happen this afternoon, which is going to be focusing very much on a book called The Climate Diplomat, which was written by Pete Betts, who sadly died a couple of years ago. The book's available in the GB bookshop, and he was the chief climate negotiator for Britain at the various COP negotiations over the last few years, and was responsible for writing the Paris Agreement, I believe. So lots of insights to be had from our expert panellists, who are going to be introduced by Grace Pengelly, who is no stranger to Greenbelt. I'm sure some of you recognise her already. Now, Grace is found most recently on her Substack, which has the fantastic title called The Murmuration. That's just genius. The Murmuration. Do look it up on Substack. And also on there, she hosts the Brave New Worlds Book Club. So look out for that. I'm going to hand over to Grace now, who's going to talk to us about the other two panellists. Please give a very warm welcome to them all.
Good afternoon, everybody. Lovely to see you here. Thank you very much for coming to this incredibly special conversation that I am just thrilled to be hosting and bringing to Greenbelt. Aside from writing on Substack, my day job is as a book editor, and it's very much in that capacity that I'm here today. And I want to talk to you about one of the most special books I've ever had the privilege to work on, The Climate Diplomat by Pete Betts. Books come across book editors' desks in all sorts of different ways. This book first came into my life when a journalist from the Financial Times sent me a message and said, look, did you know that there's this guy called Pete Betts? He's one of the most remarkable figures in the climate movement, responsible for leading both the EU and the UK's climate negotiations at COP. He very sadly has been diagnosed with a brain tumour, but he's been writing a book, and the last thing he wants to do before he dies is finish this book. He needs somebody to help him do that. Are you able to be that person? And I was like, crikey. That sounds like quite a tall order. But I went to meet Pete and his brilliant wife, Fiona. And over the course of the next 6 months before he died, we worked as hard as we possibly could to get the manuscript to a point where we felt that it would be, you know, good enough to publish. And by some absolute miracle, posthumously, we have been able to publish this book. It is such an important piece of our climate history. It's a book that I think will become shared on university lists and become essential reading for anybody who wants to understand how human beings have been at the heart of trying to fix some of our most complex and extraordinary problems that we face as a human species. So that's the context for why we've got three people here and no author. We are here to try and share as much of Pete's life and legacy with you as we can, and to also share with you some of the insights that Pete included in his book as well. So as I was thinking about who would be the best people to do this, Pete's wife Fiona was obviously the very first person that I wanted to be here to talk about Pete's life and legacy. Fiona, in her own right, and let me bring up her job title, is the chief executive of the Regulator of Social Housing. So is also a top-notch diplomat and a very, very clever and serious person in her own right. But she is here today to talk about her husband, Pete. Fiona also deserves an immense amount of credit for this book. She spent an entire year of her life working on it and has just done the most brilliant job of advocating for her husband's legacy. And the other person I was really keen to get here is Seppi Gulzara Munro, who is an independent climate and energy strategist in both public and private initiatives. And I wanted to bring her here because as you'll read in the book, Seppi was one of Pete's colleagues at a lot of these climate negotiations, and I think can really give us an insight into what a brilliant man he was and how on earth he was able to kind of coax all of these different countries and people together against the odds. So I've shared a little bit about how I got to know Pete. And the first question I was going to ask Seppi and Fiona was, when was the first time you met Pete and what were your impressions of him? Fiona, do you want to go first?
So I met Pete at a New Year's party, a little bit delayed New Year's party on the 8th. On the 8th of January, 1990. And it was a Sunday and it was an afternoon party. And I've always worked in housing. And Pete at the time was working in what was then the Department of Environment. And he was working on housing policy. And he was in the opposite corner of the living room of our friend's flat. And, he said something about, you know, what he was working on, and I could hear him. And as he tells it, I yelled across the room in a very uncouth Scottish accent, ex-policy, that s***. And so I didn't put him off that much. So we then, as he used to tell the story, we then had a bit of an argument across the room, which he always tells that I won. And that was kind of it. And then a few months later, at the same friend's, we went round. Pete was a big rugby fan. I'm a big rugby fan. We got invited to our friends to watch the Scotland-England game at the end of the Six Nations. I think it might only have been Five Nations at that point. Can't remember. And Scotland beat England to win the Calcutta Cup and the Grand Slam, which might have been the last time that happened, but it was amazing. And that was it, really. We were together from then on.
Brilliant. Seppi?
Well, this isn't exactly the first time I met Pete, but the most standout moment was when I was in the Department for Energy and Climate Change. My desk was two along from Pete. For the 2 years that I was there. And I remember coming back from the kitchen with my two times 200 grams of hazelnuts, because I loved hazelnuts. I was obsessed with them. I was coming out, he's like, "What you got there, you fatty tomato?" And I was like, "Yeah, I like this guy. He's my kind of guy." And that was what was, you know, from there on in, we became fast friends. But what was really interesting is, you know, I was two seats down from Pete, and I actually didn't directly work on the negotiations. I was in the finance team, the people that were developing the projects that were being, you know, implemented through the climate fund, the International Climate Fund, where we would develop projects in like India or in East Africa, etc. But we always sat along from one another, and he was so interested in people. And from my accent, he could tell I was Scottish, so immediately starts telling me about Fiona, his wife. So I heard about Fiona for years before I met her. I was starting to wonder if she actually existed, Mrs. Betts. And but also he found out I was from Iran, and he starts speaking to me in Persian. I was like, who is this guy? You know, not only does he call me Fatty Tamati, but then he can speak to me in my mother tongue, in Scots and in Persian. So I was very impressed. And that tells you something about the man, like immediately, you know, find something in common with someone, and the relationship develops from there.
Yeah. And I think what comes across in the book, which you should all buy, by the way, it comes out next week, but it's available in the bookshop now, is in the very first chapter, Pete kind of, you just get the sense that he's not the typical civil servant that we hear about in the UK. You know, like he's not coming from Eton. He's not coming from a public school background. This is a guy who came from an incredibly working class background and somehow over the course of his career gradually moved up the ranks in terms of seniority. Fiona, I'd love for you to just tell us a little bit more about how you think his background and that sense of him coming from a working class environment shaped his approach to work, and particularly how he approached his relationships with other people.
Sure. So anybody who hopefully buys and reads the book will get a really clear sense of Pete's authenticity. He was just one of the most authentic people. He never ever said anything trite or inane in his life. He was really super engaged with kind of everything and everybody, as Seppi's just said. And for reasons I won't rehearse, he abhorred dishonesty. He was the most honest person, sometimes to a fault. He really did have to temper it occasionally, but he was the most honest person you could ever meet. And a combination of that and, you know, reasonably pretty humble kind of origins meant that he didn't have airs or graces. He didn't look down on people. He really was a kind of, I mean, he was a total curmudgeon at times, but he was a real people person. And I think, and he was a very untypical civil servant. And I think a combination of all of those factors meant that he was just a breath of fresh air, both for other civil servants, but particularly for ministers. And he absolutely believed in and held close to the sort of civil service mantra of speaking truth to power, presenting the options to ministers, but ultimately ministers decide. And he would never, ever back off or sugarcoat it, because, you know, that wasn't his job. And I think you know, most ministers absolutely got that and really welcomed his advice. And then I think you take all of those factors together, when he started, and it grew over time, he did, you know, civil service rotate people on jobs. But over time, when he started to work on climate change and do the kind of international stuff, all of those attributes meant that he was really good at making connections with people from all over the world. And as he described it himself, at one point he was described by a senior civil servant, a fast streamer, described Pete as the fast streamer from the gutter because of his accent and his vowels. He was a Londoner, he was a Battersea boy, you know. But when he was in an international context, you couldn't tell that. And I think he really kind of, you know, his own attributes and the fact that you couldn't place them in the same way as you might do in, you know, amongst the Etonians and what have you in the civil service, meant that he really did make his mark very quickly with people.
And I think that's the really key point for me, is that, you know, whenever I had to present anything to Pete, I mean, you know, this man was as sharp as anything. And, you know, yes, curmudgeon, but curmudgeon with a big heart, but also not in any way afraid to just say what he thought in a constructive way. It was never personal. It was always to do with the work. And I personally valued that a lot. I got a lot out of it. And when you're in the international arena and there's so much mistrust and potentially double dealing, and in these negotiations, I mean, you have to be on top of your tactics. But he was incredibly tactical, but the way he would play it, every single counterpart knew they could trust what he was saying. He wouldn't lie. He was, but you know, it's not to say that he, you know, had his cards all out, because he was an excellent strategist, an excellent tactician. But people, when he said something, people could trust him. And so that's why, as a negotiator coming from the United Kingdom, leading the European Union, interfacing with people from countries, you know, really vulnerable island states, and, you know, really poverty-stricken countries from around the world, they felt that they could trust him, because not only did he didn't look down on anyone, he didn't look up to anyone, everything was eye to eye. And so no matter where you were from, you knew that you had a real human in front of you and you could trust what he said.
Yeah. So I think that brings us beautifully to discussing the actual negotiations themselves, which really are the heart of Pete's book. So he kind of takes us through any of the COPs that he attended. He gives his own first person perspective of them. So there's one chapter, I think, is it Copenhagen, where he's like sat in the room with Obama and Merkel, and it's like, oh, it's all kicking off. It's really exciting. But he's giving the insider perspective that I think a lot of the time in the media gets lost in the way that we talk about COP. COP, for those of you who are not aware, is the Conference of the Parties. It's the international UNFCCC climate forum that meets, is it how often? Every single year to further, you know, our international negotiations on the climate. I would say it's safe to describe the reputation of COP at the moment in quite a perilous state. I think that the public have quite a disillusioned feeling towards these negotiations. And I think, you know, a lot of the public think there's kind of a sense of there's a lot of hot air going on, but what, you know, what's actually happening? And reading Pete's descriptions of these meetings really made COP start to make sense for me in terms of understanding it from this human perspective. Because when we talk about a conference, you're not thinking about human beings, are you? You're just thinking about this like glob of diplomats and politicians being thrust into a room. But what Pete describes at every single one of these conferences is the importance of, as Seppi has described, reducing things down to this human level, and getting people around the table and finding these points of commonality rather than difference. And so I guess that's kind of where I'd love to, for both of you to kind of touch on now, is specifically, maybe we'll touch on some of the bigger, more well-known COPs like Copenhagen and Paris, and the Cartagena dialogue. Why did Pete make such an extraordinary contribution to COP, in your opinion? And what were those extraordinary contributions?
So I think Pete, over time, became more and more committed to, you know, climate, the importance of solving or at least mitigating the climate crisis. He started off, you know, as a negotiator about what's the UK's interest, and they quite quickly moved away from that, I think, and became, you know, what's in the world's interest, what's the global interest, and used to regularly be described by, you know, peers in Treasury and what have you, as, you know, a semi NGO, but always with the backing of whoever the minister was at the time, so that was kind of fine. And I think what Pete was doing, given what we've just talked about, he was so good at trying to kind of bring people together, get common views, get to common ground. And I think one of the things that both meant the most to Pete and where he made the most difference was when he became the lead negotiator for the European Union, because that really played to his natural tendencies to try and kind of bring people together, as I say, and kind of aim for that. He was really good at kind of mastering both a degree of technical detail, but being really strategic and seeing the big picture and bringing people together to kind of find the common ground. And he managed to really, along with others, he would never say he did this on his own. He managed to really, I think, push the EU to be really quite ambitious in the offers that it would make at the COPs. And there is something about, you know, everybody trying to kind of push for ambition so that the more recalcitrant countries might kind of feel the pressure and feel the pressure at home from, you know, civil society, what have you, and they would up their game. So he managed to get the EU to do quite a lot of that. I think Copenhagen was, and I can remember Pete coming back from that and being with lots of other people very, very deflated. I think one of the big lessons they all took from Copenhagen was that they had been overly optimistic and they hadn't quite realised how hard it was going to be to bring, you know, the US, some of the emerging economies, you know, Saudi Arabia, China, people who had a lot to lose if they had to, they perceived had a lot to lose if they had to up their ambition. So Copenhagen was seen to be a failure. But we were all talking about this earlier. in Copenhagen, the one thing that I think gave some cause for optimism is a smaller group of vulnerable countries, including some vulnerable countries, came together to find common ground. And they met, as we were saying earlier, in the Cartagena Room in Copenhagen. And that turned into something called the Copenhagen Dialogue, which I think is the thing that Pete is very well known for and was one of his proudest achievements. And he, that was a coalition with Australia, but with Colombia, a remarkable woman called Andrea Guerrera García. They spent the next 5 years between Copenhagen and the lead up to Paris in really trying to find that common ground. And read that bit of the book. It just is astonishing. And actually, what I think that meant was by the time it came to Paris, and there was lots of people, there is no single architect of the Paris Agreement. But by the time they got to Paris, they knew where the landing grounds were on lots and lots of really knotty, tricky issues. And he'd put the legwork in, along with lots of others, but Pete was just so driven to find a way through this. And after, I think in some ways, almost the failure of Copenhagen probably allowed that momentum to build in a way that it might not otherwise have done.
And I just want to go back to something that Grace said about, the maybe antipathy towards the COP. I think it speaks to something much broader in our culture where, we are becoming less and less patient as a society. Actually, there's another book on this called The Weirdest People in the World, which I cite all the time, that says that since the 1970s, we want instant gratification. You can see it in our own personal lives. You can see it in our politics. You can see it in our politicians. And when you read this book, you will see that the COPs are the one place, perhaps, where patience and the long game is what delivers. Because as Fiona said, this groundwork for Paris was laid for 5 years at least, if not, longer, but very deliberately for 5 years. And, Pete very masterfully takes us through this, this book. And it really is fascinating that he's made something so technocratic, so absolutely, I find it riveting. I honestly do. And I'm not just saying that. And, because I do a lot of media commentary as well. So I do, at COP26 in Glasgow, I think I did about 40 interviews and things that journalists constantly ask you, is this a success or failure? What's been achieved? Nothing's been. And, again, it's that lack of appreciation for what has been done in order for us to get to where we are. So while something might seem like a small outcome, and everyone wants to say, have we solved climate change or have we not? This is the long game. This is patience in action. And this is an antidote, I think, to what is kind of going quite badly wrong in our culture, which is that inability to be patient and think towards the future.
Yeah. And to kind of reflect on how do humans actually get stuff done? There's another writer and philosopher, Rebecca Solnit, who I think speaks to your point absolutely beautifully. She says, change, sometimes it feels like change happens overnight. And everything all of a sudden, we get the Paris Climate Agreement. Oh my goodness, isn't that incredible? 1.5 degrees, what a miracle. But other stuff, it takes time. It takes time. And I think this long view and trusting humans, trusting the way in which humans can organise themselves around these existential crises, that's something that Pete really got. He really understood it.
And to that point, I think it's really important to draw out. And what you'll get from this book is not only that understanding of the long game, the strategy, the tactics, but really very much the human that was engaging in those. And as Fiona alluded to earlier, he was called the fast streamer from the gutter. He did feel like an outsider, and he was an outsider insider, But that was his magic. And you see that in this book as well, is that, you know, there's something in here that perhaps many people can identify with. You might see yourself reading it yourself when you are reading this book, because there's something there about you're doing the work he was doing. He was so focused on the broader strategic outcome that maybe others couldn't see. And he was going back to his department and being told by his superiors, oh, well, maybe it just doesn't, you know, let's just, you know, these negotiations are going nowhere, because they weren't in it. And they weren't willing to invest in understanding. And there's something in that about he carried on regardless. And the drive there is just magnificent. And you can behold it when you are reading this book.
Yeah. And the fact that the book exists is also testament to that. You know, this is somebody who literally, until the day he died, was so passionate about fixing some of these problems and communicating the lessons that we need to understand about how to fix them. I do just want to turn to the kind of tail end of the book. So we've covered some of the cop work. So we kind of go through this history. And then in the final section, there are some kind of quite pointed, specific suggestions that Pete has about reform of the COP process, and also the bigger picture about where international politics is going. And I remember getting some of this manuscript as he was writing it, and he, you know, was predicting that Trump was going to get a second term. And I was like, no way, you know, there's no way we're going to get a second Trump term. He was obviously right. And, you know, so I think he had this amazing propensity to really nail the geopolitics, nail the direction that our societies are heading in. Fiona, would you be able to illuminate for us a little bit some of the key arguments that he puts forward in terms of both reforming COP and then also kind of culturally what we need to be doing? And then I think, I don't know how we are for time. We're good for time. Okay. Yeah, sure. That's right.
Okay. So as has been alluded to, Pete thought the COP had many flaws. One of, I think, its biggest flaws in his view was there was no legally binding mechanism for countries to set targets, and then if they didn't meet them, there were sanctions for it. And he, throughout the book, talks about how do you push for more ambition in what are now called nationally determined contributions, and, you know, each country setting out what it hopes to achieve in terms of reduction of greenhouse gases against the 1990 baseline. And one of the things he sets out in the book in terms of things to change is having a moment. COPs happen every year, as Grace has said, but every 5 years it's kind of like a major COP. So Paris was one of those, and that was exactly 10 years ago. Glasgow was the in-between five-year one. Pete sets out one of the ways to reform COP is to have a moment in advance when every country in the world, and there's, depending on how you count them and what point in history you are, there's about nearly 200 countries, and it all has to be done by consensus, by agreement. But each country sets out its own contribution early and makes that open to scrutiny, so that, you know, civil society can scrutinise, UNFCCC can scrutinise, that really pushes to sort of raise that ambition and lets that kind of have that sunlight period where it's not just left to the COP itself. You push much harder in advance of the COP. And I think that was one of the kind of key things he wanted to do in terms of COP reforms. The other point that you'll see in the book, and again, this has been alluded to, is although COPs have, you know, been criticised, and in some cases rightly so, there is no other forum that brings every country in the world together. So, you know, there's been various options about doing this all through the G20, or the vulnerable countries wouldn't be involved in that. And so you really need to kind of think very carefully about, you know, the downsides of any alternatives. But leading on from that and the pushing for high ambition, there are the when the original Rio summit set out the sort of climate agenda going forward, I don't want to get too technical here, but the countries were split into Annex 1 countries, which was all the developed countries, and non-Annex 1 countries, which were developing, in inverted commas, countries. And some of those developing countries, rightly at the time, included countries like China, etc. Some of those countries have become much richer over the years and much bigger emitters over the years. And one of the things that Pete talks about a lot in terms of culture is that that developed-developing distinction has been held onto for too long, in some cases quite tightly by the countries involved, including countries like China or what, you know, various others, because they weren't on the hook to the same extent in terms of their emission reduction targets. And Pete considers that culturally, both the left, well, particularly the left, but also a little bit the right, there's been a holding on to some of these distinctions that prevents people being clear-eyed about what the actual problem is, what the position of different countries is, and what the solution needs to be in terms of emission reductions. So there's a real issue about kind of not letting culture kind of slightly maybe outdated definitions get in the road of the actual facts that, you know, need to be seen clearly if you're going to mitigate climate change.
And on that point, there's something really important for us all to consider, which is, you know, when we are looking at these processes, when we are assessing them, this whole bracket of, you know, developing versus developed countries, is outdated. Many people know it, but there still seems to be this real reluctance, this fear of scrutinizing in the same way some of the non sort of Annex One, not the original developed countries. You know, there's a lot of focus on developed countries, and rightly so, but there's an argument in Pete's book that I very much agree with, that again, being clear-sighted about this, when you look at actual emissions, I'm sorry, you just simply can't not scrutinize the emissions of countries like China. And there is this reluctance, I think, in civil society, in NGO movements, to do that, which sort of goes against the broader objective of climate change and is being blurred by people's fears and obfuscated by, you know, outdated cultural perceptions.
Yeah, fascinating. And really encroaching on uncomfortable conversations, which I think is one of the, you know, final points that he kind of emphasizes, is that we need to become more comfortable at having uncomfortable conversations with each other, because it's the only way that we are going to make real meaningful progress on this stuff. We can't continue to you know, carry on as normal, because clearly this stuff isn't working. I think one of the final points that I wanted to bring out in this conversation, we very much talked and tried our best to talk about Pete in terms of the human being that he was. But I think the book is also appealing to each one of us to embody very different qualities and values to the ones that our society seems to prioritize at the moment. And so I'd just like Fiona and Seppi to kind of touch on what are the values that you think, if Pete was sat here today, what are the things that he'd be urging the people gathered round to be taking away from his book and, you know, getting real with?
I mean, look, you know, Pete was such a great, so he's such a great laugh. He was so much fun. He was, and you know, don't know what impression we're giving, but he certainly was no meek character. And there's other folks that in this room that I know who worked with Pete. He was bolshy. He was, you know, if he disagreed, he would say it. He'd never make personal attacks. He would attack ideas, and honestly, I loved that about him. But unfortunately, I do think that there's a sense more broadly that people take, you know, the robust argument and robust kind of shaking up of an idea and interrogation of idea really quite personally. And, you know, I think Pete would urge us that when we are looking for solutions, that we have to be open to having these difficult conversations, because it is definitely not all kind of apple pie. I was going to say motherhood and apple pie, but motherhood is certainly not apple pie. So anyway, it's you know, it's not all apple pie. And I think for me, that was one of the greatest things about Pete. And it also goes to the point I made at the beginning, which is why people trusted him, but also why, unfortunately, there was, you know, backlash sometimes. But I think he would say to us, that's part and parcel, guys. That's the way it rolls. Like, when you're trying to do something difficult, you cannot be put off by the resistance. And that is something he embodied so well.
And it's interesting talking about, you know, what would Pete describe in terms of the values, because I don't even think he thought about himself in that way, to be honest. He just was what he was. But I think you know, the things that I would describe Pete as in terms of values, and Seppi's covered some of this already, but you know, that real commitment to sort of seeking the truth and honesty. He was really, I mean, he could be dogged. And believe me, it wasn't just about climate change. I mean, honestly, you know, it could be exhausting at home sometimes, you know, when you just think, oh, just let it go, it's fine. So honesty and kind of really seeking truth, I think, would be definitely one value you would describe Pete as. Utter integrity. I mean, he just couldn't tell a lie. He used to, you know, when we first knew each other, and for a long time afterwards, if he was winding you up, if he was sort of fibbing, you would ask him something and he'd go, no. And his head, so whatever he was coming out of his mouth when he was trying to fib, his head would do the opposite movement, because he just could not, you know, that just really spoke to what he was like. I think the other two things I would pick out is, obviously, as we've said many times over in this conversation, his relationships with people, that relationships really mattered and building trust really mattered. And then I think the final thing was determination and resilience. I mean, he used to come home from the COPs and he was utterly battered. And, you know, it took days, if not weeks, for him to recover. And he was just it was really, really, I mean, everybody who goes to COPs, I've never been, but, you know, I'm sure it's the case. But as soon as he came back from Copenhagen, even though that was perceived not to have gone well, you know, you can read it in the book, within days back at work, he was right, okay, how do we get something back out of this? How do we find a way through this? He was utterly resilient, and it showed all the way through his illness, and the fact that, you know, he was determined, utterly determined to get the book done.
Thank you, Fiona.
Can I just add to that?
Yeah.
I think that point about the COPs is really important. And Fiona, I remember, you know, when I was in the Egypt COP and I phoned you and Pete and we were on the call together, and I was just like, God, I'm knackered. And I was just felt so miserable. And it's just so, you know, people think this, like, international travel and international negotiations are, like, glamorous. They're definitely not. But I remember Pete saying on that call, he was like, yeah, you know, I felt, you know, because I said, I feel so lonely. And he said, yeah, it did feel lonely. And I felt lonely. And it was funny because when I observed him, I mean, I did go to some COPs with Pete when I was doing various work with them as well. And he never let it, I would never have known. I remember him saying that to me. It was the first time I'd heard it, because just that sheer resilience and determination to find the solution. And I think one final thing that we talked amongst ourselves was humility. And what's really interesting, we were saying, is that you don't normally, like, you know, the word humility maybe, you know, conjures up a sort of meek character in someone, you know, someone who's a very humble and it's not about that. Pete was, like I said, he was bolshy. He was, you know, he was chatty. He was, his humility was in the fact that he could go in there, he'd interrogate an idea, he'd have a view, and he would have a discussion. He'd listen, and he could change his mind. And how many of us can say that we can do that? I think that is one of the things that really, really stood out for me.
Thank you. I think we're going to wrap things up with a very brief little excerpt from the conclusion. And then if we've got time, we can take a handful of questions. Is that okay? Thank you.
So we have a mic with a long cable. I can come to you. So any questions?
We're going to do a quick excerpt.
Is that okay?
Then questions.
Okay, thank you. So this is right at the very end of the book, and this is a subchapter headed Focus on Solutions, Not on Converting Thinking. And Pete writes, in the end, it's not that complicated. We need to emit far fewer greenhouse gases. Each country needs to do this, and those with more wealth and resources need to help those with less. Increasingly, we have the technologies to do this affordably, and much can be financed by the private sector if we can get the international support and enabling their environments right. Let's do it. If we can do this, we can improve the quality and quantity of life for people across the whole planet. In doing so, we may be able to make a big impact in reducing global poverty and inequality by ensuring affordable and clean energy for all, while building enhanced resilience for poor countries against extreme weather events and reducing their debt burdens. It may be that the West, China, and the Islamic world can agree on the desirability of that, even if we cannot agree on wider values. That is, for me, a compelling and inspiring vision. I don't have much time left, and I've been reconciled to my early departure from the moment I received the news. There are many worse things than death. But to repeat, I urge people of goodwill on all sides to pursue the art of the possible rather than turn climate into a culture war issue. It's simply too important for that.
So, questions, please. I'll come to the first one I saw, and then I'll move on to over here. Yep. Can you keep the questions short and to the point, please?
Thank you very much. Seppi, you touched on a kind of impatient world, and particularly thinking about the 24-hour news cycle, the role of social media, which perhaps wasn't prevalent in Pete's early work. I wonder what your reflections are on how negotiations and negotiating has changed today, and perhaps what Pete's take would be on that.
Well, I mean, it's a fantastic question, because we saw that in play in Glasgow, where Boris Johnson was running around just trying to get the short-term headlines while the negotiators were in the room negotiating an agreement. And I think it isn't all bad in the sense that you can use that to create momentum. I mean, you know, with COP26 in Glasgow, there was the whole like cars, cash, coal and trees, which were all sort of outside of the agreement. This is the thing about the international arena, is you've got the specific negotiating text that is part of the UN framework. But around all of that, you have sort of bilateral agreements. You have agreements between, you know, a group of countries. And again, it's all about momentum. So you can use it to your advantage. But I think it would be, it certainly can affect the negotiations. But it always has done, to be honest, when one country goes out and speaks to the press about a certain aspect that can then derail the whole thing. But that's, in a way, always been there.
And so it's still, it's just obviously like everything, it's just times, you know, X 100, X 1000 really.
Hello, thank you for what you've shared. I'm really looking forward to reading the book because I think international diplomacy is fascinating. I work for a peace charity. We are immensely frustrated that the carbon emissions of the military were not included in the COP climate accords because it would have stopped it being agreed. From your conversations with him, what were the things that were just nagging at him that never quite either got on the table or got far enough on the table? That sort of, you know, dinner side or in the office, why can we never make progress on X or Y?
So I think I alluded to it a little bit earlier. I think one of the things that, and this comes out really clearly in the book, was nobody ever pushed hard enough for raising the level of ambition of reductions in greenhouse gases. And it wasn't legally binding. So even COPs that were described, including Paris, that were described as being very successful, and they did do good things like set some of the framework there, but were not on track. And so I would say the thing that frustrated Pete the most was that sense of, you know, nobody pushing hard enough on ambition. And everybody's got a role to play on that, you know, everybody's got a role to kind of push your government, civil society, all the rest of it, and urgency. Because, you know, you need to make this happen now. You know, we see the effects, you know, all over the world, all the time. And, you know, we just need to up our ambition and really, really push that sense of urgency. And I think those would be the two things that Pete would say he wanted much more of.
I mean, just on that, I thought it was a fascinating section in the book where he talks about the point at which nationally determined contributions came about, and that it was originally posited as nationally determined commitments, because that's what he wanted. But because that would then, you know, be perceived as taking away the sovereignty of a nation state. But just to reemphasize that point around, you know, taking that broader push of what's needed. But I think something else as well that comes out in the book really strongly, and that certainly we talked about and I've mentioned already, was this thing about, you know, you can't just, because it's comfortable for you, keep focusing on the developed world. You know, you have to get uncomfortable. It might feel uncomfortable, you know, challenging other countries. You should still keep challenging the developed world. He never said anything other than that. It's not like he wanted an easy ride for anyone else. But you have to, as civil society, as, you know, citizens, be open to challenging the others as well, because this is a global game and we've got to play it that way.
Thank you. A question about time and about relationships, really. One thing that I think came across in the discussion is the mix of urgency and also the fact that you need to, that these things take time. And I was lucky enough to work in the energy department back in sort of 2010 and the few years afterwards, after Copenhagen. And I remember the Durban COP, which was in 2011, where there was something that was slightly precociously called the huddle that saved the world, in a small group of people getting together and trying to sort out the wording that would then pave the way for the Paris Agreement. And it still took 4 or 5 years after that to get to Paris. And I think that it really comes back to what Seppi was saying, that in this world of instant gratification, sometimes things do just take time. And what was really unusual with Pete was that he was in that role for a very long time, actually, in the UK and then in the EU period. And you sometimes need that and that commitment. And in that, he also built up those relationships with other chief negotiators in China, in the US and elsewhere. And I wonder if you could just say something, Fiona, about not only what that was like, but also what he chose to do after he found out his diagnosis, because I found that incredibly moving in terms of actually bringing people together to recognize the work that they were doing.
Thank you. That's a really brilliant question. So Many of you might know that the civil service typically rotates people around, as generalists around lots of different subject areas, typically every 2 to 3 years. And that can work really well in some areas. But Pete was really unusual in that he just ended up being so committed to the climate change cause that he did it at various different points over his career, but the last time was for a whole 10 years, and you needed that expertise and you needed those relationships. And as you will read in the book, sometimes he resisted attempts to get rid of him, because there were some attempts to get rid of him, because he did, for all that was said, he was great with people and relationships. He did fall out with some people. So, he kind of clung on and he was really, really committed to it. And he talks about how much it matters having some of that experience when you go into the next COP and the next COP and the next COP. When Pete discovered he was ill, so he'd been out of the civil service, he because of the pension arrangements, he stopped working as a civil servant in 2018, and he was diagnosed at the end of 2018. He stopped working as a civil servant. And he was diagnosed very early in 2022, so 3.5 years after he finished working as a civil servant. And he'd carried on doing all sorts of things outside the civil service that were connected with climate change, etc. As soon as he realised he was ill, and I was musing on this morning actually as I was coming here, he got so many people together in so many different combinations. We had sing songs, we had amazing meals, we always were having people. It was a constant stream of visitors, and he just wanted to bring people together and keep that conversation going. And I'm not sure this is necessarily what you're alluding to, but one of the things he did that turned out to be exactly a year before he died, was he decided he wanted to have what he called a pre-funeral so that he could be there for it. And I wouldn't let him call it that, but he did anyway. And we had the most amazing event that another very good friend of ours, Selena, along with lots of other people, organised at the Scottish Dole Hall, actually, in Whitehall. For climate colleagues from all over the world. And I think you can maybe find a recording of it online. It was just astonishing. And people spoke so highly, both of Pete, but also of how important it was to keep going on the climate kind of cause. Genuinely, people came from all over the world, which maybe wasn't good for carbon footprint, but... but three of the main speakers were from each of the three main political parties in the UK. And that was really important to him, that actually, and it speaks back to the kind of culture walls thing, there are some issues that are much bigger than other beliefs or party political affiliations. And so we had Ed Miliband spoke, Amber Rudd spoke, and Ed Davey spoke. And that three-way cross-party talk, I think, it was just the most, I was in bits by the end of it, it was the most moving event you could have had. And it spoke to his, ongoing belief that the only way you can fix this is for, as it says exactly in the end, people of goodwill to come together and never give up.
Thank you so much for what you shared. It's been brilliant to hear. The question I've got, we almost rely on international negotiators to set the policy that then determines what the rest of us can work with. But as people who are ambitious about creating a better world, is there anything that we can do to support those people who negotiate?
Should I take that? Absolutely. And, you really have hit the nail on the head, actually, because you're right to identify, and this is what so many people miss when they kind of dismiss the international negotiations, is that the reason we have so much of what we do have at the moment is because the tone was set painstakingly for hours on end negotiating a word or a comma or a phrase in these negotiating rooms over years. And it's not even just the, you know, each year that they'd meet. It would be every single meeting, as Fiona will well know, would keep going off, you know, every few months and then going for bilaterals to build up to those COPs. But what's really interesting about the time that we're in now and the place that technology is in, and the constraints that we face. I mean, if we just take the UK as an example, you know, we are building out lots of renewable energy, but we're constrained by the grid. But aha, we do have solar and batteries and smart technologies that are really there, affordable and much more easily deployable. And so that is starting to take off from the ground up. So now what we're seeing is this, I would argue, hopefully, not virtuous enough, but a virtuous cycle developing. It could be more virtuous, again, to emphasise, where the work that still needs to happen at national level, because listen, we still have to do work at national level, we still have to do work at international level, because that is where the big emissions reductions are, and that's where the big regulatory set pieces can be developed. But actually, we can embolden all of that by showing what's happening in the real economy. So that looks like your communities coming together to put solar and batteries in their premises to then not only cut their bills, but cut their carbon emissions. That looks like, you know, really being supportive of inconvenient infrastructure coming through your way, because I think this is something we all need to grapple with as well. You can't have it if you're not willing to put up with some of the inconvenience, because we do need to build more infrastructure. That is a fact. So there's something to do in your own homes, in your own communities, that will take you so far. But that's the message it sends to the policymakers. But there's also the recognition that there are trade-offs here, and we need to be inconvenienced as well to build some of the pylons and some of the infrastructure that we need. And I think those two things are key. And then talking about it, communicating, because it's always the people who disagree that are the loudest, and it's us who agree that are, you know, sitting back being like, oh, it'll all be all right in the end.
Can I just add something? Yeah, I just want to add one other element to your question that I think is really pertinent to Greenbelters, as many of you will consider yourselves part of civil society. In terms of how can we support and enhance the work of negotiators, again, one of the things that Pete expressed frustration with is civil society and the NGO sector occasionally, you know, creating campaigns with all of the goodwill that that entails, but campaigns that are not based in relationship with the negotiators who then have to go and enact this stuff. And for me, that was a real wake-up call when I read that, because I was like, do you know what? That makes so much sense to me. It makes so much sense in terms of my experience of nonprofits and civil society campaigns, that so often nonprofits, and, you know, they're doing great work, but often they're also operating in a bit of an echo chamber and not speaking to the people in power who actually can do the stuff that they are campaigning for. So I have a bit of a, you know, request of people sat here. If you're working for a charity or a nonprofit, think about strategically, really think about who is the person in the position of power that I need to be establishing that relationship with over a long course of time, and asking and asking for more information with.
Thank you very much, Fiona, Seppi and Grace. I had the honour of, Pete was my boss for quite a few years when I was quite a junior civil servant, so I can't wait to read the book. I always remember him, my abiding memory was he was always the centre of a huddle. Like, you go off to a COP and there was always a sort of circle of people like around Pete trying to find out what was really going on. You've talked very much about the COPs and the sort of evolution. It's taken 30 COPs, if you count the two that COP 4 or whatever it was, to get as far as we've got. What lessons can we learn to make the things on, like, or plastics? Like, the plastics COP fell over last week. What can you learn that you could take from the wisdom of people like Pete and not have to make the same mistakes on biodiversity, on persistent organic pollutants, on plastics and so on.
So I'm not, as you can probably tell, I'm a housing person, not a climate person, and I've not been to a COP. I was heartened when the plastics thing fell over, because the countries that were being more ambitious would not accept the less ambitious deal. And I was really heartened by that. And I think there are lessons in the book that you could take into other spheres around find a way to undermine the blockers or work around them, and find a way for those who've got ambition and who can find common ground to get that agenda pushed forward. But I think sometimes you have to fail before it really gives people that wake-up call to kind of shake themselves.
Thank you, everybody.
Can I just say, yep, there's a picture of one of the huddles in the book. Oh, yeah. So if you get the book, then you'll see a famous picture of a huddle.
We believe that there should. So the book comes out next Thursday. Hurrah! Super exciting. Look out for coverage in The Guardian and other places over the coming weeks. Talk to your friends about it, share it. We need all of the help that we can get, obviously, as we don't have an author like most books have the benefit of. But thank you so much for coming. I've absolutely loved this conversation, loved speaking to Fiona and Seppi. Please give them a huge round of applause. And I'm sure they might hang around at the end for a little bit in case anybody else has any burning questions about climate negotiations for us. But yeah, thank you, Greenbelters, and thank you for being such a great audience.
Thank you, Grace. Thank you so another round of applause. Thank you so much. And do enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.